Now, as I'm sure you're aware, the subject of tonight's lecture, this talk, is mind control. And when I talk about mind control, I'm not talking about devices for controlling large societies, such as propaganda, disinformation, coercion. What I'm going to be speaking about this evening is the actual technology and methodology that has been developed. Actually, there are a number of technologies and methodologies that have been developed to control the individual human consciousness, literally to physically control the human brain and human behavior. There are a number of very important strategic considerations to take into account in discussing mind control, and those strategic considerations will occupy a considerable amount of the talk that I was about to say broadcast this evening. There I go again. I'm still getting used to talking in front of a live audience. I'm so used to speaking on the radio that I often refer to questioners from the audience as caller, which you're not a caller, but I suppose maybe in 6 months or a year I'll get over that. But in the talk this evening, I'm going to be talking about the strategic importance and of mind control, how it is applied, as well as many of the technologies and methodologies that are involved in this very, very terrifying and very important technology or methodology. But one of the most important aspects of mind control, in my opinion, is that it represents a profound development in the evolution of the human race. People, as I've said, always tried to coerce human behavior in a variety of ways. They can, or to control human behavior, they can misinform a person. They can get someone to believe in a god, and then through that belief, they will undertake any one of a number of things which they might not otherwise undertake, or they can be coerced. You can threaten to torture someone or kill them or hurt their family. But these have all represented means of attempting to motivate people in one way or another. Mind control is a tremendous leap forward in terms of behavioral control because it represents the ability, or it doesn't represent, it is the ability to subvert the individual human will, to make people do things not only against their conscious volition, but without their conscious recall, including, if necessary, taking their own lives. And this is a tremendous step forward for the human race and something which is extremely unfortunate. We have not. Albert Einstein said of the atomic bomb that its development has changed everything but the way we behave. I think the same could be said of mind control. With the ability to control an individual's behavior and brain against their conscious volition and without their recall, human beings have actually acquired a power, an ability which had previously been relegated only to deities. We had assumed that God could make us do things, or the devil, or whatever. Now human beings can do that, and it represents a tremendous evolutionary development. And I'm afraid that it has certainly represented a backward development. It has not been used in a positive way for the most part. It has been used in a destructive way. It is more important, in my opinion, the development of mind control technology than the development of nuclear weapons proper. But from a philosophical standpoint, I think that in the age of mind control, and as you will see this evening, we are certainly in the age of mind control, we have taken a leap into an entirely new realm of human existence. We are not just now attempting to motivate people either through disinformation, terror, or coercion, but we can actually make them do, or an intelligence agency or military service can make people do what they want them to do regardless of whether or not they want to do it, simply by controlling the human brain in a physical sense. Now, there are a number of different applications of mind control technology. These technologies have actually date, some of them, including hypnosis and pain drug hypnosis, date back to the Second World War. One of the most important uses of mind control technology has been to develop assassins who will not only kill against their will, but will, if necessary, be made to forget about killing. They will be made to forget about who they have assassinated. And if necessary, they can be made to take their own lives, so that if you really want to get rid of somebody, you can program someone to kill them and then either erase their memory so the person has no recollection of it, or if they were spotted and if someone could identify them at the site of the killing, you can have that individual eliminate themselves, commit suicide, and that, of course, eliminates the possibility of any criminal investigation. Another major application of this technology has been to improve couriers and spies, traditional elements of military and intelligence strategy over the years. But with mind control technology, you can create a courier or a spy whose memory can be made much, much, much better than an ordinary human being's or even that person's memory under normal circumstances. You can also program someone or develop a courier or a spy that has learning abilities far in excess of what that individual or any other normal individual would have under the circumstances. I'll be talking about some of these as we get into the lecture as a whole. Also, a major focus of mind control technology is to create couriers or spies who are torture-proof. If you can get an intelligence agent or a military service person to carry information or to acquire information in their subconscious through the use of hypnosis and post-hypnotic blocking, this individual will only recall that information, whether it's a message being carried from point A to point B, or whether it's information that has been gleaned from espionage. Say you send someone into a defense plant, you have them memorize certain blueprints. That can actually be done. A mind control courier and spy can look at blueprints, memorize them, and then, after being administered any one of a number of possible cues, will be made to forget that information completely, even under torture, tortured to death if necessary, without ever divulging the information until a proper cue is given, at which point the individual, not unlike a computer, disgorges the information that they have at their disposal, but buried in their subconscious mind. This is not conscious information, it is unconscious information. Another application, which I will not be discussing in as great length as some of the others this evening, is the use of mind control to create cults of pliant zombies. The Unification Church, for example, they're the People's Temple of Jim Jones. Other cults have apparently been not only the focus of mind control activity vis-a-vis their adherents, but have also formed very important liaisons with the National Security Establishment. In some cases, it appears that they were actually formed by the U.S. National Security Establishment. By that, of course, I mean the U.S. military and the intelligence agencies. The single most important and, to my way of thinking, terrifying application of mind control technology concerns what I call cordless mind control, or the remote control of human behavior, whereas mind control would normally entail hypnotizing a person. Usually hypnosis is used in conjunction with a number of other things, such as the administration of psychoactive drugs, psychosurgery, operant or Pavlovian conditioning, which I will discuss in a few minutes. But remote control mind technology using electromagnetic radiation, microwaves, ultrasonics is now an ongoing reality in the United States. It is probably an ongoing reality in certain other countries as well, but the available literature on mind control suggests very strongly that, as has been the case with all other military technologies, the United States is far in advance of any other nation in terms of its application. Remote control mind control, the ability to read the human thought process at a distance, which is, according to the information available, now an existing technology, this is something which holds implications for the human race which are absolutely terrifying. We also have a lot of evidence, and I'm going to be reading from a paper that I read on the air some months ago. And by the way, Paul from Archives on Audio is seated over to my left and has a number of tapes not only dealing with mind control, but he also has the Harlan Girard paper from a NATO Advanced Research Workshop that was held in January of 1991. Not only can the human thought process now be read at a distance, but human beings can be controlled through the use of various kinds of electromagnetic radiation, such as microwaves. Voices can be made to be heard in their head. Their autonomic nervous systems can be made to respond in a number of terrifying ways. Enormous pain, unbearable pain, can now be administered at a distance without any sort of physical interface between the torturer and the victim. So just as we have learned over the years to communicate over great distances, we now do not even think very much about picking up a telephone and calling someone on the other side of the world, or listening to a radio program brought from a different part of the world, or watching a television signal that has been bounced off a satellite. These are things which we take for granted at this point. There are very firm indications now that mind control, that torture, can now be administered over a considerable distance as well. I am afraid, although there is no hard literature that I have seen, I am afraid that within the next decade or two, satellite technology is going to be interfaced with some of the microwave mind control that I'm going to discuss during the closing phases of the broadcast this evening, or the lecture this evening. There I go again. So that, in a sense, a signal can be bounced off a satellite, or a satellite can generate radiation which could be pinpointed on a given individual or a very small place on the Earth. And the implications of that are about as terrifying as anything, I think, if the human race could ever imagine. Just consider the possibilities of throwing a switch and having a satellite orbiting the Earth using the remarkable surveillance technology available, where the license plates on cars can now be read by a satellite, focus in on a given individual, press a button, and subject them to any one of a number of horrifying experiences, all, I guess you could say, in the comfort of one's very own home, if we could call it that. This, I think, more than anything else, heralds the evolution of the human race into an entirely new dimension. The sociological, philosophical implications of this couldn't be exaggerated. Now, literally, we as human beings are emerging into a realm of power that had previously been considered only available to a deity. Yet we do not have the souls of gods. We have the same old corrupt souls that we've always had, but we now have abilities that had only been accessible in our imaginations to a god. So at this point, I think the development of remote control mind control, cordless mind control, the use of microwaves, the use of high-speed computers to read subtle changes in the electromagnetic field around a human being. We are all surrounded by a weak electromagnetic field. And as I will be discussing, it has been found that when human beings are thinking, this produces subtle changes in that electromagnetic field. And right down the road here at Stanford Research Institute in the mid-1970s, a successful program was developed where computers could monitor the subtle changes in the electromagnetic field around the human body corresponding to their EEG, to their electroencephalograph, and that they in turn could affect the electromagnetic field in such a way as to reverse the process. This, in many ways, I think, negates what we have always considered by privacy. This negates what we have always considered to be human rights. When you do not have the privacy of your own thoughts inside of your own head, the whole idea of privacy ceases to exist. The founders of our Constitution, the drawers up of our Constitution, could never have envisioned such a reality, such an eventuality. Well, that reality and eventuality is now upon us, and we are going to, as a species, have to develop enormously as moral creatures in order to prevent what I suspect will ultimately be the catastrophic applications of these technologies to social control. If we do not, as a species, develop an enormously greater character, an enormously greater moral outlook on ourselves and our fellow human beings, then we are going to be doing unto ourselves what we have always been doing unto ourselves, namely, for the most part, great harm and violence, but with abilities, with technologies, with powers that had, as I said, only been considered something in the realm of a deity, possibilities that only a deity would have been viewed as having in the past. Another application of mind control, in particular some of the remote control or cordless mind control techniques that I've just been alluding to, is to produce, quote, psychotics, unquote, people who are, quote, mentally unbalanced, unquote, and who would therefore be used to, in essence, they would be used as de facto agent provocateur. I've spoken about on my program such people as Patrick Edward Purdy, the fellow who went off on the children in the Cleveland Elementary School in Stockton in January of 1989. I've also discussed some of the, or what the late Mae Russell referred to as the California violences, the Manson killings, the Zodiac killings, the Zebra killings. I've also discussed the massacre down in Killeen, Texas, where this fellow went off and shot some 22 people. There is substantive evidence that at least some of these supposed lone nuts who've just flown off the handle and begun wiping people out may actually have been subject to mind control, and that they have been obliged to do what they did in order to terrorize the masses of human beings. These massacres, these serial killings, are not generally viewed as political events. In reality, in my opinion, they are extremely political. They serve to terrorize people. People are afraid to go outdoors at night. People are afraid to make new acquaintances. One hears the phrase so often, well, you just don't know what's going to happen. There are so many nuts around. Well, these killings have a profound effect on our society. They create, and I will discuss this more later in the lecture. Got myself that time. I will discuss this more later. They create the will on the part of people to have a much less free society. They will endorse the increase of police powers and surveillance powers, the reduction of civil liberties by the courts, something that unfortunately the Reagan-Bush new improved Supreme Court has been doing only too good a job of so far. These things, these lone nuts who go off and massacre a bunch of strangers, are extremely important in terms of the political and social makeup of our society, and I think there is substantive evidence that at least some of these people have been deliberately programmed to engage in the horrifying acts that they have been engaged in. One of the things that I'm going to be doing this evening also is I am going to be relying to a greater extent upon excerpts read from papers and books, and also some taped excerpts than I have in some of the past lectures. In this sense, tonight's discussion is going to be more akin to an archive show than a lecture. I'm not going to just play tapes and read, but because the other lectures that I have given were descriptions and analyses of sequences of historical events, they lent themselves more readily to a lecture format. Although most of tonight's discussion will certainly be a lecture, will be more or less off-the-cuff representations of some of the things that I've jotted down as subjects of discussion. Because we are going to be describing technical processes, many of them scientific processes, plus journalistic accounts of phenomena that are not generally very well recognized, even by relatively well-informed people, relatively well-informed individuals concerning the methodologies of our intelligence system and intelligence agencies and military, I'm going to read more and play tape excerpts more so that you will actually get to hear some of the things that are going on and some of the things which, tragically, most of us do not have a substantive awareness of at this time. Now, the first major category, the first major application of mind control technology, and this will occupy a large segment of the discussion this evening, concerns the use of mind control technology and mind control methodologies to develop assassins. There have always been people who would willingly take out other people's lives, who would always eliminate some of their fellow human beings. Assassination is as old as Cain and Abel, if we can believe the Bible. But with mind control technology, it is now possible to improve the art, if one could call it that, of assassination in a number of ways. In the first place, as I said, assassins can be programmed to kill against their will. They can be programmed to murder someone that they would not otherwise kill. In the context of a military hierarchy, it has long been possible to order someone to kill another person, even if they might be reluctant at first to do that. The Nuremberg statutes mandate that it is a matter of international and moral law that if a human being is ordered by a superior, either a governmental superior, a military superior, or a governmental superior, to perform an immoral act, say, machine gun a bunch of women and children, they have an absolute legal duty to disobey that order. Tragically, the Nuremberg statutes have not taken effect nearly to the extent that they should, but we should note that with mind control technology, it is possible to completely subvert the Nuremberg statutes. It is now possible to create people who will kill people they would not otherwise kill against their volition and, if necessary, without their conscious recollection. This is one of the ways in which the development of mind control technology revolutionizes, in a bad way, the world that we live in. Most of our moral and political precepts are based upon the notion of the individual human will as the supreme arbiter of human behavior. Mind control changes that. Now, some of the technologies that have been applied to the art of developing assassins concern the use of hypnosis. This has been used for a long time. Hypnosis is rarely used by itself. It is usually used in combination with a number of other technologies, ranging from psychosurgery, the actual physical alteration through surgical process of the cerebral cortex of the human brain. Hypnosis is also used in connection with psychopharmacology. One of the truisms of hypnosis is that not everyone can be hypnotized, but that is only true in terms of classical hypnosis. If you administer any one of a number of drugs appropriately called the sedative hypnotic class, these are widely used, for example, in psychotherapy for dealing with people who are deemed, quote, psychotic or seriously neurotic, unquote. With the application of any one of a number of the sedative hypnotic drugs, sodium amytal, sodium pentothal, any human being can be hypnotized. Hypnosis, in addition to psychopharmacology, is also paired with what is known as pain drug hypnosis. A person can be drugged and then subjected to a number of painful processes so that while under hypnosis, they are in reality, are being conditioned. The conditioning process in terms of classical behavior theory, and psychology was my major when I was an undergraduate, generally falls into one of two categories. There is Pavlovian and operant conditioning. Most of you are familiar, I'm sure, with the experiments run by the Russian Pavlov, who conditioned dogs in such a way as a stimulus administered by the experimenter produced an involuntary physiological response. What Pavlov did is he took a dog and gave it a plate of meat, at which point the dog would salivate, obviously. Then what Pavlov learned to do was to administer a cue, either a bell, which was what he used. You could also use a visual cue, such as flashing a light. He would ring the bell. Then he would give the dog a plate of meat, and the dog would salivate. After repeating this process a sufficient number of times, Pavlov eventually discovered that he could get the dog to salivate by simply ringing the bell, because within the brain of the dog, behavior theorists don't even talk about the brain, they simply talk about stimulus and response. In response to the stimulus, the dog gave the involuntary physiological response which was associated with the presentation of food, i.e. salivation. The other major type of conditioning is what is known as operant conditioning. And both types of conditioning figure in terms of the conditioning of assassins as well as couriers. I'll talk about how these interface in a minute. Operant conditioning is different from Pavlovian conditioning in that operant conditioning involves the conditioning of they don't talk about conscious response, but of a learned behavior. For example, you would take a monkey in a cage and you would administer a food pellet to the monkey. And the monkey obviously would eat the food pellet. Then what the conditioner learns to do, or what he does, is he would flash a light and then introduce the food pellet. So obviously when the food pellet comes in, then the monkey eats the food pellet. Or you could use a rat, a pigeon. Lots of these things have been, these various paradigms have been developed. B.F. Skinner, Burris Frederick Skinner, is perhaps the best known of the behavioral psychologists. He pioneered many of these techniques along with Thorndike. But what operant conditioning then involves is instead of flashing a light or ringing a bell and introducing a food pellet, you flash the light, at which point the monkey or the pigeon or the rat or whatever it is then anticipates its reward. But you don't introduce the food pellet or whatever the reward is until the organism, the experimental organism, learns to perform a response. What you do is you introduce the food pellet if the organism, the pigeon, the rat, whatever it is, presses a certain lever. Now, generally, in the random behaviors that the experimental organism exhibits when it does not get its reward, it will usually hit the lever. If the rabbit is used to getting a food pellet, when it sees the light flashed, it will exhibit an increased degree of agitation. It'll start looking around for the pellet, and probably in the course of that, it will trip this lever, or press a certain lever, quite by accident, at which point the pellet will be introduced and the organism gets its anticipated reward. What behavioral scientists have found over a period of time is that it is very easy, although it requires patience, to condition an organism to perform that response to obtain the desired reward. Eventually, what you get is you get a rabbit or a pigeon that will hit that lever whenever it sees the flashing light or whenever it hears the bell. That is what is known as operant conditioning, the conditioned elicitation of a learned behavior. The other is Pavlovian conditioning, that is the conditioned elicitation of an unlearned behavior, in the case of the dog, salivation. Operant and Pavlovian conditioning are paired with hypnosis, psychopharmacology, psychosurgery, the actual physical alteration through surgical process of the human brain. They all figure in to the development of mind control assassins. Now, one of the fallacies concerning hypnosis as it applies to assassination particularly, and I was recently told this by a stress management therapist of my acquaintance from Southern California, she assured me that under hypnosis, a human being cannot be made to do anything that they would not already do. This is absolutely wrong, but it is a common tenet of medical hypnosis. You will hear this demonstrable fallacy bandied about a great deal. It is true that if a person were hypnotized and in a hypnotic trance and were then told, "This is your mother, shoot your mother," assuming that they did not hate their mother and would not shoot their mother, or any other loved one, or a superior officer, and I'm going to talk about this in a second, it is true that they would not shoot their mother. But what has been demonstrated conclusively, beyond the point of intelligent debate, although largely this has been missing from the literature, is that although you could not place someone under hypnosis and say, "This is your mother, shoot her," you can say, "This is a dangerous criminal who is going to come at you with a knife, shoot them, and the person under hypnosis will not be capable of distinguishing between the individual with the supposed individual with a knife, a criminal about to attack them, and their mother, and they will shoot the individual to death if necessary, thinking that this is a dangerous criminal. Upon being brought out of the hypnotic trance, the individual would then be overcome with tremendous grief at having shot their own mother. They would not shoot their own mother, but they would shoot their mother if, under hypnosis, they had been led to believe, they had been instructed that their mother was, in fact, a dangerous criminal. One of the seminal works on the military and intelligence applications of mind control, one of the works which is liberally accessed in Radio Free America programs 5 and 6 about mind control, is a book called Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowart, B-O-W, A-R-T. It's published in softcover by Dell in 1977, or copyright 1977, and it is one of the main works on mind control, the best in my opinion. There's also a good book called The Mind Manipulators. Interestingly enough, authored by a fellow named Alan Shefflin, S-C-H-E-F-L-I-N, a professor right here in the South Bay at the University of Santa Clara. There are other good books, The Mind Stealers by Samuel Chavkin, C-H-A-V-K-I-N. This deals primarily with the abuses of psychosurgery. And there are a number of other books that deal with mind control to one extent or another. The best, in my opinion, is Operation Mind Control. Now, there is an experiment done by the U.S. military right after World War II, which is described in detail in Bowart's Operation Mind Control. This concerns an enlisted man who, under hypnosis, was instructed that his superior officer was brought into the room after the enlisted man had already been hypnotized. Now, in the military, as I'm sure many of you know, you do not attack a superior officer. If you want to spend a long time in Leavenworth breaking rocks and eating lousy food, you physically attack a superior officer, and you will most assuredly do that. There is next to nothing that you can do in the military which represents a greater breach of military discipline than to attack a superior officer. No enlisted man in his right mind, assuming he's a good soldier and in a state of health, is going to attack a superior officer. But an experiment was done in which a good soldier, an enlisted man, was placed under hypnosis. His superior officer was brought in, and bear in mind this was right after the Second World War, and the enlisted man had fought in the war in the Pacific during the closing stages, and the enlisted man was told by the hypnotist, by the experimenter, that his superior officer, he was not identified as his superior officer, said, "This is a Japanese officer who is going to kill you." At which point, the enlisted man furiously attacked his superior officer, obviously perceiving this as a Japanese officer. He brought him down to the ground and was in the process of choking him. The experimenters took him off. They were able to get the enlisted man off of him. At that point, the enlisted man was taken out of the hypnotic trance and was absolutely stunned to discover that he had in fact attacked his superior officer, something he would not otherwise have done under any circumstances. Again, he would not have attacked his superior officer even in an hypnotic trance if he had been told, "This is your superior officer." But when told this is a Japanese officer attacking you, he attacked his own superior officer with full combat ferocity in an attempt to kill him. And this is an indication of what can be done under hypnosis. There's another experiment done by a hypnotist in the Midwest in which a woman was put into a hypnotic trance. Her sister, whom she was very close to, was brought into the room. She was given an unloaded pistol and was told that this sister was another individual whom she hated, and she was instructed to kill her. The woman then turned and fired the empty pistol, pulled the trigger repeatedly at her sister under the suggestion that this individual was in fact an individual whom they deeply hated. Upon being brought out of the hypnotic trance and immediately after pulling the trigger, albeit on an empty gun so it did not kill her sister, she realized what it is that she had done, and she passed out. She fainted from shock. that she was able to do such a thing. This is an indication of what can be done with hypnosis, but the authorities do not even leave things to the relative chance that that would entail. Hypnosis is combined with a number of other techniques, including what is known as ESB, electronic stimulation of the brain. If you study physiological psychology, or if you really study introduction to personality theory, you take Psych 101, you will eventually come across a fellow named Dr. Jose Delgado. Delgado did a very famous experiment, supposedly in the early or in the late 1950s, but probably much earlier than that. No, I guess it was the early 1960s, but actually much earlier than that, in which a Spanish fighting bull, a purebred fighting bull from the rings, had electrodes implanted in its brain. Delgado had a control panel wired to radio receivers at the end of the electrodes, and Delgado stood, and there's an actual film of this experiment, Dr. Delgado stood in the middle of the bull ring. The door to the bullpen, I guess it would be called, was then opened, and this bull, a purebred fighting bull, and Spanish bulls are used in the bull ring, are bred for their ferocity as well as strength. They're bred to attack. The bull then promptly, seeing Delgado, went right at him, lowered its horns, but before the bull could gore him, Delgado pressed a button on his control panel, which sent a radio signal to the receivers connected to the electrodes implanted in the bull's head, at which point the bull then promptly turned around and ceased its charge. Delgado has long sought what he describes as the electronic and physiological control of the human brain. It is interesting that Delgado's research on ESB, on electrical stimulation of the brain, on electrode implantation and consequent control of behavior, human and animal, was funded primarily by the Office of Naval Intelligence from the United States and the Office of Special Investigations, which is Air Force Intelligence. In a book called Mind Control by Dr. Peter Schrag, last name S-C-H-R-A-G, there is a very interesting observation concerning Delgado. When Schrag interviewed him in the late 1960s, he observed that Dr. Jose Delgado had white hair. There was a little bit of gray, but his hair was almost white. It was a silver color. His hair had changed. Originally black, had changed to gray and silver almost completely. The technical film of Dr. Delgado and his bull shows a man with jet black hair. His hair is completely black. He might have had a few gray hairs, but it does not show up in the film. Obviously a much, much younger man. Supposedly the experimentation had only been done a few years before. But Schrag speculates, and I think there is in all probability a great deal of substance to his speculation, that in all probability the Delgado experimental work with the bull and with ESB was done many, many years before it first became public. So that in all probability, this technology was being developed. And bear in mind that Jose Delgado was being funded by the Office of Naval Intelligence and OSI, Air Force Intelligence. In all probability, these experiments were conducted many years before they allegedly were conducted, and they were conducted many years before they became public. One of the interesting things about Delgado is that he is an authoritarian's authoritarian. He has made a very famous statement that, quote, man does not have the right to control his own behavior, which obviously is a philosophy. That's an outlook which is about as directly antithetical to everything we have always thought about in terms of freedom and democracy. It was Jose Delgado's view that human beings should not be allowed to exercise irresponsibility. He said they should not be allowed to control their own behavior, and he saw electrical stimulation of the brain and the application of remote control of behavior, just as he had with his bull, as the ideal solution. If we could implant an electrode or a silicon chip in everyone's head, we could then control them by remote control, and this would eliminate all of these troublesome things such as freedom and democracy and other things that Jose Delgado manifestly did not believe in. One of the techniques which has been developed using some of the methodology of Jose Delgado is something which is about as much of a mouthful as anything you're ever going to hear. It's a technique which is called RHIC-EDOM, all in capital letters. What RHIC-EDOM is, it's radio hypnotic intracerebral control and the electronic dissolution of memory. What this involves is the implantation of a radio receiver into the cerebral cortex of the individual to be controlled. This radio receiver can then be used to administer a tone or an electrical signal in the cerebral cortex to which the individual, having been hypnotized, would be conditioned to give a response, say pulling a trigger if he was an assassin, or any one of a number of other possible conditioned behaviors. The implantation would also be used to produce a surfeit of a neural transmitter called acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is one of the major chemicals facilitating nerve transfer from nerve cell to nerve cell in the human brain and nervous system. However, when acetylcholine is overproduced, it functions in a manner which could be analogous to a traffic jam. When you have too high a level of acetylcholine in your synapses, in the gaps between the nerve cells, then it actually blocks nerve transmission. It blocks neuronal transmission and serves to either alter or, if necessary, completely eliminate human behavior. I'm going to read to give you a more detailed description of RHIC-EDOM. I'm going to read about it in Operation Mind Control. Once again, this is Operation Mind Control by Walter Bowart, B-O-W-A-R-T, published in softcover by Dell, copyright 1977. About RHIC-EDOM, Bowart writes as follows. In 1975, the RHIC-EDOM story surfaced again. This time, a Tennessee journalist said he had been given top-secret documents by two former CIA officials whom he would not identify. The journalist, James L. Moore, M-O-O-R-E, said that the papers in his possession described the details of, quote, a military technique of mind control called radio-hypnotic intracerebral control, electronic dissolution of memory. Moore described the RHIC-EDOM file as a 350-page scientific report which was prepared by the CIA immediately after the murder of President John F. Kennedy. He said it described a way of turning men into electronically controlled robots programmed to kill on command. According to Moore, in the initial RHIC stage of programming, the prospective killer is put into a deep hypnotic trance and conditioned to go into trance at the sound of a specific tone. Quote, a person may be placed under this control with or without his knowledge, programmed to perform certain actions and maintain certain attitudes, unquote, whenever he hears the tone. Again quoting, effective for a lifetime, Moore said, control may be triggered weeks, months, or even years after the first hypnosis and programming. Medically, Moore continued, these radio signals are directed to certain parts of the brain. When a part of your brain receives a tiny electrical impulse from outside sources such as vision, hearing, etc., an emotion is produced. Anger at the sight of a gang of boys beating an old woman, for example. This same emotion of anger can be created by artificial radio signals sent to your brain by a controller. You could instantly feel the same white-hot anger without any apparent reason, unquote. The second part of the process, electronic dissolution of memory, or EDOM, Moore said, is more complex. Quote, In the brain is a chemical called acetylcholine, which carries electrical impulses from the eyes, ears, nose, nerve endings, etc., to the part of the brain where memory is located. Memory is nothing more than the recording of these electrical impulses, and acetylcholine is the path or wire that connects the inner brain to the nerves of your eyes and ears. By electronically jamming the brain, and what he's talking about here is the over-secretion, the overproduction of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, by electronically jamming the brain, acetylcholine creates static which blocks out sights and sounds. You would then have no memory of what you saw or heard. Your mind would be a blank, unquote. Moore said that according to CIA documents, excuse me, this method can be used either to block the memory completely or to slow it down so that events seem to have happened later than they actually have, unquote. Now, this is a technology which is known to have been operational for a long time within the bowels, so to speak, of the U.S. National Security Establishment.